This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Teachers Talk Radio this afternoon. You are listening to the afternoon show, which I've renamed Education and Cocktails, with me, Jane Manzoni. I am broadcasting to you live from cloudy London. I have three fabulous guests for you this afternoon, a very good friend of mine and Senko, Victoria Nunn, Eugene McFadden of the Badger Set.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Hi again. One of those days I'm going to get it right. So my third guest is Alan Sue. Sorry, Alan. I thought I timed it just right, but obviously I haven't quite perfected that introduction yet. Hello again. I'll start a bit with a bit more about my guests to start with. First up, I've got Victoria Nunn. Now, I've known Tori for well over 25 years. We go all the way back to university. Tori's got a background in psychology, but she's been in education for 21 years in mainstream and specialist provision. Primary and secondary. Now, Tori is the director of SendEC LTD, which I expect she'll tell me a bit more about when I interview her. I think she's going to be my second guest, actually. First up is Eugene McFadden. He is also a Senko in a large mainstream school. He is a founding member of Badger Ed, which I will be grilling him on because nobody seems to know what that's about. Eugene has been in education for 19 years. He was a youth worker, a TA, and then a teacher. His background is in SEMH schools, but he is in mainstream now and has been for 5 years. And last up, I have Alan Sue. Sorry, Alan, for missing you off the intro. Alan has been the subject lead for computing at his primary school since September 2020, and he's been teaching, I think, in primary since 2015. He was in civil service before that. Alan's got a son and daughter and a wife who I think is a doctor working on the COVID vaccine. I wasn't sure from his bio, but I'll ask him about that when he comes on. Okay, so a bit about my week. This is my third week in reception. I've almost finished the baseline assessment. Hallelujah. I've got 7 more children to do the number part with. I did see some people tweeting about it, but I don't think you can officially talk about the contents of the baseline assessment as it comes in the official packet and says, don't discuss this with anybody. So people who've been tweeting about that, I'm not sure they should be. I did find out this week that there is a summary of each child available to me. I wasn't sure there was. I thought it just all went off to the government. There's a summary which just says what the children got right and wrong. Now, that might be useful, it might not, considering the children have been in school 5 minutes when I did it with them and they answer questions differently all the time. I don't know whether it's solid data or not, but the government seems to want it. So I have done it and we made it into a game and it wasn't that bad in the end of the day. I don't think they really realised what they were doing. They just thought they were counting things and answering a few questions to do with phonics. Besides the baseline, I've been making cloud dough. You may have seen my tweet on that, banana cloud dough. That is made with equal parts conditioner and corn flour. It's really gooey and more difficult to make than the cooked version just because of the sheer mess you make and you get it all stuck up your arm. But once it comes together, it's remarkably soft and very much like ice cream because I'm doing an ice cream stall next week, which is why I use banana conditioner. My question of the week to Twitter was courtesy of my mother. Now, I guess I should have realised it would be nothing to do with education. She asked me to ask Twitter what your favourite electrical appliance was. The results were most of you like coffee machines. I had that from Fatima Durden, Andy McHugh, Miriam Vickers, Lonnie Fennis. I won't say any of the makes of the coffee brands. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to advertise. This was closely followed by washing machines. And Mr. Darby liked his chainsaw. Richard Cliff liked his power drill. A few people liked slow cookers. I liked the simplicity of kettle submitted by CS Cube. The most teachery answers, Mr. Leaney offered an electric pencil sharpener and a description of how it changed his teaching life. And my friend Barry Smith said he liked his cordless vacuum cleaner because he recites as he vacuums, probably Charge of the Light Brigade. I do want to see that in person. There was a couple of electrical appliances I'd never heard of before. A Bluetooth mirror. Joe Penn's got one of those. I guess it plays music. And a Pro Curl. Jenny at Teacher's Pet said she liked her Pro Curl. Apparently that sucks in your hair and magically curls it. So I thought this week I would get people to text in a bit more. I didn't really get that going last week or the week before. So if you want to text in your favourite electrical appliance, feel free and I'll read it out. I'll also be asking you to text in your favourite cocktail. I could read those out. And I'm going to ask you the question to do with my education list of the week as well, which I'm going to tell you who is in just a second. So on to my cocktail of the week, which is a Flying Dutchman. I've never had a Flying Dutchman. I had to find a Dutch cocktail to link to Gert Biesta because he is Dutch. A Flying Dutchman is made with gin, triple sec and ice. I'm sure it tastes nice. What I have noticed is the frequency that triple sec comes up as a mixer in cocktails. It seems to be in everything. Triple sec is just like an orange flavour liqueur. It's in an awful lot of cocktails, and I never knew that before I started doing this research to find out about cocktails of the week. Now, I've linked to Biesta because I read this book that I've got in front of me now, The Beautiful Risk of Education. I read it years ago, and it kind of stayed with me. And through all the ups and downs, the knowledge-rich curriculum, and all the, shall we say, more modern books that everybody's talking about on Twitter, this is the one that really the ideas stuck with me. I'm going to read you the introduction and ask you a question to do with it. It says, this book is about what many teachers know but are increasingly being prevented from talking about, that education always involves a risk. The risk is not that teachers might fail because they are not sufficiently qualified. The risk is not that education might fail because it is not sufficiently based on scientific evidence. The risk is not that students might fail because they are not working hard enough or are lacking motivation. The risk is there because, as W.B. Yeats puts it, education is not about filling a bucket, but about lighting a fire. The risk is there because education is not an interaction between robots, but an encounter between human beings. Now, I know we've heard that lighting the fire rather than filling the pail a million times, but really, if you think about it, education does involve risk. Well, I think it does. We are dealing with uncontrollable factors. So lighting a fire is a good analogy there. But I'm going to put it to you. I'm going to put it to my three guests. Is education a beautiful risk, as Biesta puts it? Are we lighting fires rather than filling pails? So text in and I will read out if you agree with Biesta and me, really, because I agree with that as well. I think the knowledge-rich curriculum, the filling pails analogy, has been used with that because you can, I know that people are advocates for it, will say, oh no, it isn't all about filling kids with knowledge. But if you think about it, it is about making that the basis. It's making knowledge the basis. And it's almost ignoring the factor that human beings are going to interact with that knowledge. And it isn't something you can control. You know, it is a fire in a way. So with all the discussions over the past few years, I've written a few blogs about curriculum, and I'm always saying you're ignoring the person in the middle of it. And that really is what Biesta's book's about. I would recommend you read it if you haven't. The Beautiful Risk of Education, Biesta. Now, I'm going to ask Eugene. Eugene wanted to call in first while I put on the thing I have to put on. Let me just find it.
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE-validated programmes to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics. Do you struggle with people pleasing? Is it a constant battle managing different and difficult personalities? Why not inspire, challenge, and empower your team through the MAL CPD Essential Coaching Skills for School Leaders course, or gain practical skills to become a strong and compassionate leader through the Assertive Leadership and the Emotionally Intelligent Leader courses. All MAL CPD courses are accredited by the Institute of Leadership and Management. Find out more at www.malcpd.com. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat for myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club.
Hello, Eugene. Are you there?
I am there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Okay, that's great. Good. Yeah, amazing. I thought you were going to have a northern accent for some reason. Where are you living?
Cornwall, so you can't get much further south, really.
I should pay more attention to people's Twitter handles. Okay, Eugene, so have you got an educational cocktail for me? Am I saying your name right, by the way?
You are, yeah. Yeah, good. Close enough. It's fine, yeah. Yeah, it is an espresso martini.
Oh, these are so popular. I don't know why I hate them. Anyway, tell me, how do you make an espresso martini?
I buy it from a mate who has a wine bar, but I've now got her recipe, so that's fine.
Go on then.
So it is, if I don't buy it from her, it is 100 millilitres of vodka, 50 millilitres of an actual coffee, decent coffee.
This makes two, doesn't it? 100 millilitres. This must make two.
Does it?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, well, maybe it does. And then 50 millilitres of Kahlua, which is a kind of coffee liqueur thing.
Yeah.
And there's something about syrup, but I don't bother with that stuff. Put it all in, get a lot of ice, put it in an ice shaker. I tend to use my kind of teacher thermos cup thing. Shake it around, pour it out, and drink it. It's great.
And put a coffee bean on it, I suppose. I like Cafe Patron as a shot. Or Kahlua as a shot, which is a coffee liqueur. But I don't know what it is about espresso martinis. Don't really like them that much. But anyway, they are very popular. You're about the third person who said they like those.
Am I? Oh, God.
I'm clearly just
following a trend.
Okay, let's try and talk about education for a bit. What made you want to be a teacher, Eugene?
My other career options didn't happen. My eyesight was too bad for the police or the army.
Right, okay. So
literally it was just like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do then.
You started off in specialist provision. Do you think that's because you were drawn to, if you say you wanted to be a police officer, what was the other thing?
Or join the army, yeah.
Maybe special education is closer to that than mainstream, do you think?
Literally, I just opened a job paper. I opened a paper and the job was there, and I was like, oh, I'll apply for that. I had no idea what I was getting for at all.
And you obviously liked it.
Yeah, I did. I was quite good at it. Started off as a youth worker, and then became a TA in a school and became a teacher in a school.
James, who's my friend who came on the first show, he started off that way in a special school in being a TA. And then I don't know if he was a youth worker before. So it seems to be the trajectory of a few people. And what have you done so far? You're in this provision and then you've come into mainstream.
Yeah, eventually I kind of bounced around to other places for a bit and then eventually end up in the mainstream. In Cornwall. Big mainstream, 1,500 kids.
That is big. Secondary, yeah.
Secondary, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, a bit of a shock to the system initially. And then, yeah, that's it. And then they needed a Senko. So I was like, I'll do that. And yeah, five years later, I think I'll do that.
Like the easiest job in education, not. It's like the hard, yeah. I always think that that's the hardest job in the school for sure.
I think it is.
It's not something I've ever been drawn or thought that I would be particularly good at. So, but is there anything else that you would love to do in teaching that you haven't yet? We'll talk a bit more about being a Senko in a minute, but.
I think I'd like to be a head teacher eventually, once my kids are older.
How old are they now?
One is turning 9 tomorrow, and there's a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old.
Oh, that is lots of children. Yeah, they're very I mean, I'm teaching the tiny ones now, and they are so, so demanding. I can't imagine what it would be like having one at home as well. And you'd like to be a head one day. I've thought about it. I don't know, really. It's all bureaucracy, isn't it, up there? And you don't get to really talk. I suppose in a small school, you would get contact with the children.
Yeah.
But my worry would be you just get sucked into meetings and finance and whole school policies, and it just becomes a little bit less.
And all that kind of nonsense. Yeah,
yeah, what I went into it for.
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably try and find someone to do all the boring things for me and then just walk the halls the whole time.
Yeah. That would be good.
Which is more interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Okay, so what would you change in education if you had a chance?
In education or in like the kind of wider children, schools and family thing?
Well, we were going to talk about what makes good send provision later, weren't we? So maybe just generically rather than...
Generically, I think... oh, God, it's got to be funding. Everyone says funding, but seriously, we're just, you know, it would just be really good.
Yeah,
if we just had a bit more money to just actually fill in all those gaps we seem to keep finding.
There is just such a shortfall for providing for children with needs, and constantly juggling. I know we are, and I know every other teacher I know in every other school in the country, you're just constantly juggling to find the support that you need for different children, because there is so much need now. After COVID, there's even more. But it's a constant battle, isn't it? You pull somebody from one classroom to fill in another gap, and then there's a gap there, and then some other child comes who needs loads of support. So, yeah, I agree. Funding is a really big issue, and the way that... Do you want to talk a bit more now about how you would organise it differently, send provision?
I think my place has kind of got... We're quite good at it. We kind of do a lot of the really good, you know, early... We developed a really good, like, kind of fine mesh to kind of catch kids who have gone for the system and not had their needs picked up. It's that, but then, you know, that took a while to kind of develop that for different strategies. So having a kind of fine mesh there to kind of just figure out all the kids, figure out if there's anything not firing properly, whatever, that's really important. And then you've got to make sure your interventions do what they're meant to be doing.
So do you assess their
cost effective?
Yeah, do you assess them regularly, like if they're being cost effective?
Yeah, well, I do. Everyone that comes to the school gets a reading age test straight away, which is quite intensive when the new year sevens turn up. But it's got to be done. And then from that, then you can unpick the next.
Which one do you use, out of interest?
I basically, the RAP4. I use that one.
I don't know. The only one I know is like the Chanel that gives a reading age. That's like from 1973. Yeah. It still works.
Yeah, it does. We've got like, I mean... I'm a really bad hoarder. I just hoard stuff, and it finally came to pass the other day. They were like, "Has anyone got the?" I think we're doing the cats again, and I'd hoarded somehow between like 3 office changes, like 200 copies of the cats books. Mm. So we're gonna probably use those. But we use the RAP2. RAP4 is a standardized test. It's pretty much on its way out, but it gives a reading age. That's fine, and it's easy to mark. It's 50 questions.
And then you put in interventions for the children who are falling below, yeah?
Or if you've got like a reading age below 10 on that, it's either you don't understand the words, so it's a vocab gap, or it's a phonics gap. So then everyone that comes in at below a 10-year-old reading age gets a phonics check. If it's not a phonics issue, the issue is then, you know, filling in the vocabulary understanding. If it's a phonics gap, we do intensive phonics every morning. And that always pays off really well.
Mm.
So that's our main big thing we do. Because if you can't read, you can't access the curriculum.
There's a lot of other needs apart from just academic.
Yeah, there is, yeah.
What do you do? Because I just find the support for children who've got emotional difficulties and other more complex needs, when you need specialists and they are really expensive, and you need to get people in to check what's actually going on with the child, and those things seem to take so long. CAMS referrals and
everything.
I don't know how we would improve that apart from just piling money into it.
Well, and actually having more, like, I mean, the problem down here is, you know, even CAMS itself is like so overstretched. They've only got an administrator for like 2 or 3 days out of the week.
Mm.
And because I was trying to track down a report, and I was like, why haven't you sent it to me? And the guy was like, I only work Thursday and Friday. There's meant to be three of me. It's just me.
Yeah.
So even at that level, but then you got, you know, decent CAMS workers seem to go off sick because they're trying to do all these things. They can't do it. I've got a load of kids who referred to CAMS. CAMS say, don't meet our threshold. Try these guys. The next guys go, not for us. Try the next people. The next people go, ooh, too high need for us. Go to CAMS.
Mm. Yeah, so, like, I mean, I think the answer is we need more money and more investment in those, all of those things, to make life a lot easier for everybody in schools. Okay, let's try and be a bit more upbeat, because I think that's the bit I've always said. Well, I've said for quite a few years, it's the thing that's going wrong the most in education. We just don't have enough money to provide for all the different needs that we have in schools. And we're expected to provide fantastic education for all the children in our care. And sometimes when you don't have the resources, it's almost impossible to do that, because that there are children who need one-to-ones.
There are.
And therapy and things that we just don't have the time or money for.
Yeah,
okay, let's lighten it up with, first of all, how about your favourite electrical appliance? You told me actually it was a kettle, so I know, unless you've changed your mind.
No, it's still a kettle. I was going to go coffee maker, and I thought, no, because with a kettle, you can still make coffee.
That's true. Yeah. It is very useful. It's the most practical electrical appliance, and washing machines were popular as well. Let's move on to I nearly said beavered. because I put a beaver next to my name yesterday or the day before, because I'm not a badger. Let's go on to badger ed. What is this thing? What is this?
It was a really random thing.
So you're a founding member, yes?
Apparently so, yeah.
Okay, tell me about it.
I'm not quite sure what happened. I think, like Sputnik Steve, he was making some kind of badger joke or something, and it span out of there. And then Tabitha McIntosh, she's got a radio show on this as well.
I know, yeah.
She was involved as well. Rob, whose Twitter name is Biblio Geordie, and then it just kind of spanned from there and became bigger and bigger, and it became this massive, like, collection of people who don't take education too seriously.
Oh, so that's is that meant to be the defining factor? Because there's a lot of people with badges by their names who seem to take it awfully seriously. have actually argued with me at quite some length about education. So I would say on the seriousness stakes that not everybody within your set is lighthearted. However,
I agree
a few are, but I think
we're broad church. Yeah, I think we're broad church.
I almost felt like I had admittance, because Tabitha, who I considered the Queen Badger, was cheerleading for me and telling me I was in a gateway, my beaver was a gateway badger. But I don't think I'm quite in it yet. Anyway, we'll see what happens.
I know, I mean, people just rock it. There's no hard and fast rules.
We'll see what happens in new voices. You know, I'm trying my best here. I've got little pin badges and we're giving away a fluffy badger. Okay, that's made it. That has made it a bit clearer. So Sputnik Steve made a joke. Tabitha and other people took over, and you were within the first.
Yeah, that first joke. I think it was. I think Yeah, and that was about, I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. I can't remember now.
Quite a while ago.
Maybe, yeah. It's all a bit of a blur.
I know, and it annoys Andrew Old, and so that's good.
Yeah,
I've annoyed him again today. I don't think he's listening to me today, unfortunately.
Oh, but... what have you done now?
Oh, I said something. He said I was looking for attention, and then he asked for followers, and I said, me. And then he went, you know that meme, how it started, how it's going? Just taking the meme.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that one, yeah.
He did that, thinking that I'm asking for attention. Everyone's asking for attention on Twitter. Everybody is. You can't say that one person's an attention seeker. Like, you wouldn't be on there.
It pretty much is the nature of the beast.
Exactly.
Not as bad as Instagram.
Pot calling kettle black. Oh, Instagram. Oh, I don't even know how that works. I lived with somebody once who was an Instagram person. They video all the time and then put music and captions. It's a lot of admin.
It's just too much.
It is.
Oh, if I want to change one thing for education, I would just, if there's a big red button, I could just press to turn off social media for kids. I'd do that.
Yeah, I agree. It's awful, isn't it? Causes so many problems. Even in primary. Yeah. We're even getting it in primary now, so.
And I get, I mean, you know, my kid, my partner was like, when are we going to give our kids a mobile phone? I'm like, they can have a brick phone when they go to secondary school. And when they're 16, they have a real one. And she was like, you're being too harsh. And now she's like a TA in a primary school. And she's like, oh, you're right. I was like, I know. They are dreadful.
And children can't really cope with it. Not in the same way. I mean, some adults can't cope with it. You see people.
I think a lot of adults can't cope with it either. So
that's true. You have to be quite strong. It's a lot to take. And it does blur. It blurs the lines between reality and a persona that you begin to, well, hopefully I know that I'm not Hamish Smith, but you do blur the lines, and you see people getting confused with their identity. In some ways, they're taking things way too personally. So maybe I am a badger. Right, we've done the electrical advice. Have you got a favourite education secretary?
Don't feel obliged. I never really paid attention.
No, neither do I, years. Really. Apart from Gove.
I'm just like, oh, it's just another one in the place. I quite like some of Gove's reforms. I quite like them.
Gove was charismatic in a weird way, wasn't he? So he's the one that sticks in your head as the only one who really did much. He follows me on Twitter, amazingly.
Does he?
Yeah.
Oh,
I know.
Well done. Maybe you can have a dance off with him or something.
I think I'd win. Right.
Possibly.
Here's one of my last questions. I think I've covered most things with you. Do you think, here's a meaty one, education is lighting a fire, as Gert Biester calls it, or filling a pail?
And do you think about this one?
Do you agree that there is a beautiful risk inherent in education? It's a two-part question, or even three-part, like him. And therefore, we're becoming a bit too control freaky in schools, for lack of a better word. That's why I really was drawn to the idea, because it's like everybody's trying to control all these variables and out. I mean, look at the baseline assessment. Let's get a set of data. Let's see where it's going wrong. Let's sack all the teachers in primary school. You know, okay, I'm going to let you talk now.
No, that's cool. That's cool. I don't really think about this. I think it's filling a pail full of fire. No.
Okay.
I can see both metaphors, like the whole idea of like education putting things in. But I think the most revolutionary act you can perform is teaching someone to read. Because once they can read off and like do things independently and like actually come back and go, oh, I think you're wrong about things. And I think that's really important. I think it's setting fire to a bucket. Can I say that?
I agree about teaching children to read. I always thought it happened in year one, but now I've gone down to reception and I'm really seeing the beginnings of learning to read. I'm going to now say reception are teaching the children to read. Because I've been a year one teacher before and I always felt like they came in, they couldn't read and they could read by the end of it. And that was like really cool. That's why I won one of the best year groups. But reception, they can't really do anything at all. They can, bless them, but they can't. First of all, they've got the sounds. They're just beginning to blend now. So I'll go, oh, and then they'll go like dog. So they've got the end of it. And to start with, it was like pan. So I'm beginning to see them learning how to blend. It's pretty cool. Yeah. And it's also a big gift, isn't it? Because once people can read, as you say, they can find stuff out for themselves that they're interested in.
Yeah, totally. I know. And then they can just go off and like become little people. Which
they can.
Although, have you seen a reception? It seems to be like the kids that have come into reception now, because I'm a governor of primary school, as if I'm not busy enough. The reception kids have come in and they haven't got the ability to play in the same way.
They haven't
have
what?
That? Got the ability to play in the same way. Have you they seen that?
They don't play in the same way.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I haven't taught reception, but I've come from Key Stage 2. So it's been a long, long time since I've been observing closely the little ones. I couldn't tell if there's been a difference this year because I have no frame of reference. I can't talk about individual kids. I can't really talk about, I've got a tiny class. Can't really talk about, because you would easily identify different children. I've certainly noticed a lot. I'm going to write a blog about what it is that's so different about being a reception teacher in a few weeks, but I'm only just finding my feet. I think COVID has affected definitely what's happened for sure. That's without a doubt. They've been stuck at home for a lot longer, haven't they?
I don't think they've mixed with the other kids as much.
No, you might be right there. Okay. Is there anything that you wanted me to ask you that I haven't? My notes are all over the place here. Thank you for joining.
That's okay. I would have stayed longer, but I've got no, and I'll go and I've got five kids in the house, of which only three are mine. So I've
doing well keeping it quiet there in the background. Thank you, Eugene. I'm going to put on the news and I'm going to ask Tori to call in. So thanks very much.
Cool.
Bye-bye.
No worries. Take care. Okay, bye. Bye.
This is Teachers Talk Radio. And this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
As the government focuses on the rollout of vaccinations against coronavirus for 12 to 15-year-olds, the Daily Mirror is reporting that some school staff in Nottinghamshire have received threatening calls and emails from anti-vaccination campaigners. The head teacher of Chilwell School in Beeston, Nottingham, contacted police following the campaigner's actions, which he described as reprehensible. Head teacher of Chilwell School, Mr. Phillips, said he had every confidence that the harassment is not from parents or students, but that the abuse had increased since the school began seeking consent from parents for the COVID-19 vaccination. On Thursday, Conservative frontbencher Alex Burkhardt said teachers should not face what he described as unacceptable pressure from anti-vax protesters and condemned suggestions that protests could take place outside of schools. Guidance from the UK Health Security Agency suggests head teachers should contact police if they believe protests could be held outside their buildings. Earlier this month, the school in Chester had to take action after a group of nine protesters arrived at the school. Preschool meals holiday provision will not be extended next month. The government has announced that the £15 a week holiday food vouchers will not be issued during the October half term. The vouchers had been issued throughout the pandemic to low-income households whose children are eligible for preschool meals. A government spokesman said that with pupils and students returning to face-to-face education, normal school meal provision has resumed. In June 2020, Manchester United footballer Marcus Rashford led a campaign to provide extra cash for families and convinced the government to dish out vouchers in the summer holidays. The vouchers supported 1.3 million children in England. In response to criticism from a number of councils, Whitehall says alternative benefits are open to families such as universal credit, but claims can take up to 5 weeks to process. They also highlighted that the holidays, activities and food programme will be extended to every local authority in England in December. Finally, with many pupils and staff across schools in the UK reporting they are experiencing the worst cold ever, a GP has explained to BBC Newsbeat why it is happening. It's all down to the easing of restrictions because people are mixing in a way that we haven't been mixing over the past 18 months. Because everyone has been wearing masks and distancing, it means we have missed catching coughs, colds and flus. The report reminds those with symptoms linked to COVID to get a test in line with government advice, but that a cold can be treated at home with rest, fluids and over-the-counter painkillers. This has been your weekend Teachers Talk Radio News.
Hello, Tori, are you there? Hello.
Hello.
Oh, you are there. Hi.
Hi.
Right. Let's start off with your cocktail, Tori. You've got one ready for me?
I certainly have. And in fact, I enjoyed one this very lunchtime just to make sure that I still actually quite liked it. So it's called a gin fusion. And what you do is you get a handful of red currants and you muddle them with some sugar. Then you put a double measure of gin in, whichever gin is your favourite, a sprig of rosemary, and then whatever tonic you like. I have it with the aromatic tonic, loads of ice, and it's lovely. And the reason why I've linked it to education is because it has quite unique ingredients. Red currants aren't generally used and rosemary's a bit out there, but put it all together and it really works. And I think, you know, working with SEN and in the classroom and with neurodiversity, I think that just shows how we can make it work.
I like your link. And it sounds like a very sophisticated cocktail, just like
it
you.
Is. Oh, thank you.
I actually quite like the sound of that. I would definitely drink that. What did you say it was called again?
It's called a gin fusion. And as you know, I'm not a massive cocktail drinker, but actually that one I do really like. So,
yeah, well, I'm definitely going to try that. Okay, Tori, so we know each other very well, but I don't think we've talked at length about why you decided to be a teacher. I know we've definitely talked about it in passing because you were always into psychology when we were much, much younger. And then you did make the move to education. What was it that made you make that?
Well, actually, I come from a very long line of teachers, I've just found out. But so when I was younger, I used to go in and help my mum who worked in a primary school. And I think then I went to university, ended up doing a lot of psychology, really focused on child development and was absolutely fascinated by it, totally hooked by it. Left university, did the thing of don't know what to do, went to work in the city, had a really fun time, but it didn't do it for me. It was making money for other people. There was nothing really rewarding in it. And I was always drawn to going back to child development and education. And I thought I'd really like to go into teaching and really help the children who maybe need a bit of enhanced learning, a little bit extra. So my actual dream was to be a SENCO. So that led me to do a PGCE. And then as soon as I got the opportunity to take up the SENCO role in a school, that was it. And I've been a SENCO now for, I think, 10 years.
And you've just started, what was the name of your consultancy?
So that's really interesting. So I've also been working as a consultant for a secondary specialist setting. And that sort of led me to connect with other people. And we all felt really that we could use our knowledge to really help neurodiversity in schools and to really spread the message on, how we can utilise existing resources in schools to make the best possible packaging and staff, supporting staff, but also working with parents too, because it's special educational needs is all about parents as well. They've got to be on board. You've got to have that positive working relationship. So we're very excited starting up that company, Sendec, and hopefully there'll be some very exciting things to come with that.
Sounds great. I like the fact that you said use existing resources because we know there aren't any, don't we?
Well, and that's what Eugene touched on. Yeah. And Eugene was touching on that earlier, wasn't he, about, the funding and everything. And I think that, yes, I totally obviously agree. There isn't enough funding. However, we can't just sit there and just stay stationary. And I don't think many schools do that. But I think we've got to look at the things that we've got, the knowledge we have, current research. How can we apply that in a way that doesn't drain resources, that doesn't drain school staff as well? You know, we want it to work for them in a way that's almost easy to slot in that provision. And there are ways to do that. So it's very exciting. We've had good feedback so far. So, we're hoping to push that forward.
What was the research you were talking about that you wanted to me to ask you about. I haven't seen it myself. What was it?
Well, it was in the news a couple of weeks ago. It was to do with autistic spectrum conditions, so ASC, and I don't know how many people saw it, but it was interesting for many ways. It had positives and negatives. And I think going back to that whole SEN kind of viewpoint, I think it illustrates quite nicely how, yes, research is really important, but also how thinking about the other facets to SEN is also necessary to see the whole picture. So what they did was, it was a joint research project between the UK and Australia, two universities, and they wanted to see if there was any way that they could help children that had been diagnosed with autistic spectrum conditions. So they were training parents on how to respond to babies showing early signs of autism and how they could reduce the number of three-year-olds meeting the diagnostic criteria. So what they did was they took 103 infants between 9 and 14 months old and looked for early signs of ASC. And for 5 months, they asked 50% of the parents to interact with their children and in a different way. And the reason that happened was that because, as most people probably are aware, lots of autistic children, people really struggle with eye contact. And when you've got an infant, and they're learning to make the sounds, which are their first words. Quite often it can sound not like a word. So it might just sound like they're interacting with their environment, they're cooing, they're making noises, but actually what they're trying to do is talk to you. Now, if you've got a child who doesn't have autism, they will generally be linking that eye contact with you, even at a very early stage. So the parent or whoever's with that child will look at them and start that interaction because they realize they're trying to talk. Well, what they were finding with an autistic infant was that they were still making those noises, but they weren't engaging in the eye contact. So whoever was around them wasn't realizing that they were trying to interact. So they weren't really having those interactions. So what they did was they said to 50% of the cohort, please, you know, if you hear your child making those sounds, please, you know, interact with them. And the other thing they did was to play with their children in a sensitive way. So it was a very bespoke kind of interaction. And I think this is important because quite often in SEN, we have historically there's been a one size fits all, especially with something like autism. This is an autistic child. This is how we'll deal with the autistic child. Not actually looking at the personal environments. And that's what this research did. So what they found was at the age of three, there were still developmental difficulties, but the social engagement had improved. And actually, only 7% met the criteria for diagnostic of ASC, which was a good two-thirds less than previously. Now, this is, you know, you can think, well, okay, we haven't seen the long-term effects. We don't know, you know, what, you know, how valid this research is. It was a very small cohort, all these things. But, you know, there are positives. And I think one of the things as well, and going back to what Eugene was saying about resourcing, is that with CAMHS now, one of the things they're doing, certainly in the area I work in, is they're actually working with parents as opposed to the children. And I think this is a bit of a shift in that kind of view on, you know, how to work with SEN and any kind of things that can help children longer term. But what was interesting about this as well was the Twitter reaction. And
I didn't see it.
Yeah. So a lot, because I follow a lot, obviously, of the SEN Twitter sites, and a lot of parents who have children with autism, as you can imagine, suddenly felt very concerned. Well, if I'd have done that when they were younger, would they be having the social struggles they're currently having? And of course, as a parent of a child with SEN, you already feel guilty. You already feel quite often that you haven't done enough, or, you know, that. And it's completely illogical. Of course you have. They're amazing, the parents I work with. But you can see how from the other side of it, research like this can also cause people to feel quite low.
Yeah, so, I was going to say, if you publish something like that, and it's a tiny sample size, it could have an implication. You know, it could have worse negative outcomes because you make so many people feel bad, and they're
sensitive.
And also, if it isn't, if it isn't accurate and then everybody starts doing this, it's kind of like, you know, schools doing things that without much evidence, and then it becomes the next big thing, and you think you've ticked all the boxes for that child just because you've done this one thing, whereas they are such, I mean, children just like adults are very complex, and those with special educational needs even more so within a school need bespoke provision, so you can't really just think you've got the answer straight away. Okay, that was really interesting. I'm not going to ask you about your favourite education secretary, because I know you don't
Well, you
really
can
know.
If you want.
Do you want you me to?
Go on, ask me.
Who is your favourite education secretary, Tori?
Well, actually, he was junior educational minister. Can I get away with that?
Yeah, you can get away with anything on this show.
Right.
Well,
Thank
more
you.
Or less.
I quite liked David Miliband because I liked the way that he understood that educational success was dependent largely on achieving the right conditions for teachers. And I think, again, if we look at that kind of environmental aspect that the child is experiencing, then actually the sort of how the teachers are is impacting the child quite a lot, isn't it? So he actually took that bigger picture view as well and thought, right, well, how can I... you know, make this better.
It's almost the biggest factor. I think it's almost the biggest. I think it's almost the biggest factor in education. How are the adults in the schools who are controlling the environment and delivering the education? How are they feeling in themselves? You know, if they're down, if they're feeling disempowered, or they're feeling negative about their job, that's not going to be any good for the children.
No.
So,
and he had. He had a slightly different way of addressing inequality as well, which I liked.
Did he? What was that?
Because he was against faith school quotas based on ethnicity. And he said that the top pupils at each school should get into uni regardless of their grades. And
oh,
Yeah, he did. And I actually think that's really good. And I think, you know, if you look at the grade confusion this year with the A-levels, you know, and actually, you know, the way that some children were really disadvantaged with COVID more than others, and the whole state private school, you know, thing that went on with grades, you know, actually, yes, can't we just take the top cohorts and send them off? You know, everyone has different environmental conditions at home.
I think I was really fortunate in that I just got in on my interview, and they don't tend to do that anymore. I think if you could interview, I don't know if they even necessarily you have to get the great grades. I think if you interview a prospective university student and they've read widely and they know what they're talking about and they've got a real desire to learn, they might not necessarily, I know this was me, I'm describing me, they haven't necessarily read the right book or the books they were told to have read, but they've read an awful lot of other books and they've got a real reason that they've applied to that.
Yes.
Top university or university in general. And if you went more on the interview and you saw what that young person wanted to do with education, and then you took them in on potential rather than grades. I hate all this focus. I really hate all this focus on grades. That's why, I mean, I wanted to abolish the SATs back in 2000 when it was going on. I just think education is about so much more. That when you get into the wider world, Who are the people who are changing things, who are being successful? They're not necessarily always people who've got great grades. And yet now we've got this culture where, you know, 4A stars, and it's all about being perfect and having the right knowledge to pass exams. I know that I'm kind of swimming against the tide on this one, but I don't think that's intelligence. Well, I don't think that's even potential.
And obviously working, you know, as a Senko, exams are one thing that I would really like to change in education, because so many children, you know, it's so unfair that they have to sit this antiquated system. And actually, I'm afraid that's where I don't agree with Eugene, because Michael Gove really did not help. He wasn't a friend to an SEND child at all sitting exams. And I think that, you know, we could reshape it to exactly like you say, show proper true potential. Without having to do these sit down formal exams. So
absolutely with you on that. Okay, did I ask you for a favorite electrical appliance, Tori?
Oh no, you haven't yet. Right, so I'm gonna be a bit out there with this one. I love my decks that I DJ.
Your what?
On.
Oh, my your decks. Oh, yeah. This DJ absolutely. Ambition of yours.
Do you know, because it's like I go into that state of flow when I'm doing that. You know, it's so mindful for me. I've always loved music. I always loved mashing tunes together. In the car on the way to school with my daughter, we always, when we're listening to the radio, we always choose, we think which song would go really well mashed into this one. It's become quite a game. And I just think, yes, obviously, if I had to really, really pick one, I probably would go for The Kettle. But actually, for my mental well-being, being able to DJ and just losing an hour or two of my life on that, definitely has to be the Medex.
A really, really cool electrical appliance. So,
yeah,
kudos there. Okay, one of the last questions. Oh, we can talk for a bit longer. Do you think education, do you agree with Biesta? I don't know if you've read The Beautiful Risk of Education. I would recommend it. Do you agree with him that it's a beautiful risk? Are we lighting a fire, dealing with uncontrollable factors, or are we filling a pail? You've more or less answered it.
Okay, well, Jay,
you
know
can talk
me.
More about the risk. You could talk about the risk.
Yeah, if I'm always going to choose lighting a fire in any aspect of my life over filling a bucket. So I think, I mean, it's a bit of a no-brainer. I think people wouldn't go into teaching if they wanted to fill buckets. You know, I think it's all about inspiring and passion. But I think in order to find that fire, you have to know the children. Now, Biesta is kind of rooted in existentialism, and I spent 2 years of my life, weirdly, when I was a teenager, just reading nothing else but existentialism because I just got so lost in it. Yeah, I mean, it's just bizarre.
I tell and you actually, what, I read Sartre when I was about 17.
My favourite.
And I'm like, yeah. Oh, no. I couldn't finish it. No. Walking down the road. No, let me tell you the bit I remember. He's walking down the road and he saw a piece of paper on the floor. And he couldn't pick it up because he felt nauseous.
Yeah, you read Nausea. Nausea. That's my favourite book.
What are you talking about?
And you know, if I ever feel low and I don't feel like reaching for the decks, I read Nausea, which is just the most bizarrest thing because I think it would make most people feel worse. But for me, no, it's great. But again, it's about that interaction with the environment. And, you know, it's a kind of sort of top-down approach that Biesta and the existentialists are saying, whereas actually in schools, I think we need to think more of it as a bottom-up approach. How is the environment looking to that child? How can we understand that child so that we can make the environment work for them? And then if we get that right and we get that relationship right, then we get the lighting fires because we understand the child. We understand what they're interested in. We understand, you know, how they learn, what they're about. And that's how we can light that fire. So, yeah, I think obviously lighting fires is the way forward for me for many reasons. I could talk forever about that.
Yeah, great. Do you know what? I was thinking about Nausea and I missed the first bit. And I think it was really quite profound and interesting when you were saying about top down existentialism, but you want to do bottom up. Can you just kind of repeat that bit for me?
No, I was just thinking, really, I haven't read Biesta's book, but I'm absolutely going to because it sounds totally, you know, fascinating and sort of thing that I would like. But, you know, just understanding it as I do, existentialism is more about, so if you think about Nausea, it's he has no control over these inanimate objects in the world, but they
that's
make
right,
him feel
and that's
physically
why he feels sick.
Yeah, he feels physically sick when he's Rokutan, the main character.
He can't character control
the story.
It. Yeah.
He can't control it. Well, if we, you know, I don't want to make massive assumptions here, but if we're thinking about schools, a lot of children feel that lack of control. Because they are in environments that maybe don't work for them. Or we're using language that they don't understand. So we had a reception child join us 3 weeks ago and he couldn't understand why he had such a small bag with him. And when we unpicked this, it was because for the last, you know, the whole summer, his whole family had been saying, well, you know, you're starting school, you're going to school, you're going to school. And this poor child didn't realize that they were actually going to come home from school at the end of the day. They thought they were so he couldn't understand why he wanted to bring his teddy and everything, because he couldn't understand. Well, that's the sort of understanding we need to understand our children. Think about the language. Think about, you know, what's going on for them. There are different ways that we use in my school. We'll do a completely holistic kind of overview of a child. If we think they're struggling, we use Bronfenbrenner's ecological validity approach. So we're looking at all the different spheres of a child and, you know, what goes on, not just in school, but also at home. What could be affecting their learning? Is their cognitive space full of other things? All those different things go on. And I think it's that bottom-up approach, that understanding of the child that we need to look at as practitioners in education to really understand how that child is experiencing our environment. Is there anything we can do to change our environment for that child? And it's very hard in schools, especially when you've got 30 in a class. And also schools are naturally noisy places there, but it's about a child feeling safe in their environment. And there are things that we can do as practitioners at schools that can do, the whole school can do for no money, that can really change that for a child and can really make a difference.
I'm looking forward to your talk at New Voices.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it as well.
If you are listening and you're interested in what Tori's saying, she's going to expand all that in your talk, aren't you?
I am. Next week, next Saturday.
Okay. We've got, I think, 4 minutes before I'm going to ask my last guest to ring in. I know Alan has been here from the beginning. Hello, Alan. I know you're listening. Patiently dying to talk to me, I'm sure. Let's just talk very quickly about a bucket list holiday destination, because I've never asked you this. Where do you, you've been a lot more places than me, but where would you like to go?
This has really challenged me, Jane, because you know that I kind of live in the moment quite a bit as well. So, and quite responsive. So if, you know, we've been out several times and we've said, why don't we go here? Why don't we do this? And, you know, that, you know, we were going to, and then COVID happened and we haven't done things that we planned to do. I tend to be led by that, really. I don't have a burning desire to go anywhere particularly, but I will go places. So, for example, a very good friend of mine the other day said that she had tickets to a closing party in Ibiza, and obviously that kind of ties in with my whole DJing and everything. And I just thought, yeah, let's do it. Let's go just for 2 nights. It's just driven like that, really. On
so you don't want to see a thing like the Great Barrier Reef? Or
I've seen quite a lot of things, and I'm always, you know, really grateful that I've had those experiences, but no, I think, you know, it's just kind of being in the moment and enjoying it. And sometimes, you know, you see things that you didn't plan on seeing, and even better than the actual, you know, the more famous things that you've gone to see, you know. And certainly places like Rome are amazing for that. You know, you go and see the, you know, the things that everyone goes to see, but, you know, at Sistine Chapel and everything. But then you can see down a little back street, there's a little church with the most amazing art in it that, you know, no one's talking about. You know, it's that kind of experience I like.
Oh, there's amazing. There's amazing, amazing art in every church in Italy.
Exactly.
Okay. Exactly. Very last question, Tori. Would you go back in time or would you go forward in time, given a chance, to see, just to see as a visitor, as a tourist? Not like, I want to go back and be 20 again. Not that. Yeah. It's not a question. It's like, would you go back and see the Victorian era or medieval or the dinosaurs or Jesus? Or would you go forward to the year 3000 and see if we're actually still a species?
Yeah, a species. I think I would go forward, and also actually to see how their SEM provision is then, in the hopes that it has come on quite a way. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a good thing to end on. I'm going to ask Alan to ring in when I put on this set of adverts, and I'm going to say goodbye to you and thank you very much, and I'll see you next week, Tori. Okay.
Lovely. Thanks so much, Jane.
Bye. Bye.
Take care.
Need
bye.
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE-validated programmes to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics. Do you struggle with people pleasing? Is it a constant battle managing different and difficult personalities? Why not inspire, challenge, and empower your team through the MAL CPD Essential Coaching Skills for School Leaders course, or gain practical skills to become a strong and compassionate leader through the Assertive Leadership and the Emotionally Intelligent Leader courses? All MAL CPD courses are accredited by the Institute of Leadership and Management. Find out more at www.malcpd.com. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful, and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club.
Hello, Alan, are you there?
Oh, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, I'm very well. I'm sorry I missed you off my intro.
No, that's okay.
I was trying to introduce you, but then I ran out of space and I tried it three times, but I must have been slower in the real thing. Thank you for listening from 3 o'clock. I see you were here. You get to see who's listening.
Absolutely. Yeah, Eugene and Victoria were an absolute pleasure to listen to. I'm going to take it down to a very base level now.
Well, I'm going to take you on your word that you can talk about anything, because we have half an hour to fill, Alan, and that's quite a long time and we can't have any dead air time. So I'm hoping you can talk.
But I didn't
get to see you at Researcher. We'll talk about that later.
I didn't write that down
as a question, but I was going to just pop it on you. You can talk about it now.
Okay. I found ResearchEd was a really interesting experience. Meeting people that I'm connected with through the Twitter sphere for the very first time, it was quite kind of humbling. And I'm so sorry to those who did say, "Oh, hi, Alan," and I was looking kind of a bit vague and distant, unable to string more than 280 characters together in real life. But there we are. A funny story from Friday was I know Emma Sakar in real life, and she happened to see me at ResearchEd when I had just bumped shoulders with Amanda Spielman, and she had thought I was part of Amanda's entourage when in fact I was just asking her if I could get to the sandwich tray.
It is quite daunting being at ResearchEd, because there wasn't as many people at this one, probably because of COVID, but certainly a couple of the others. You said it was your first one?
Yes, it was. I saw Hallie Hughes had tweeted a post during the summer saying that she was feeling kind of, I don't want to say anxious, but she just wanted a friendly face in the audience, I think, when she'd put in her presentation proposal and had it accepted. So I tried to jump on, seeing that ResearchEd was just around the corner from where I normally work. So I tried to get a ticket, couldn't get in, but because it was around the corner, I kind of pushed myself forward and volunteered and said, "I've actually got a 40-minute presentation that's ready to go. So if you wanted it, you can have it." About 3 weeks before, I got contacted by the team and they invited me to the 3:20 slot. So I was in the top block. So not many people came, but I was grateful for those who did.
Yeah, I don't think it's about how many people come to see you. I think it's the experience. You all get videoed anyway, ResearchEd, and people then come to it in different ways, don't they? They come to it online. So your ideas are getting heard. They're getting a platform, even if you don't have a full room. I think it doesn't really matter much. But it is daunting going to those things. You started off saying you're a bit shell-shocked. Like, there are so many people that suddenly are a real-life version that you've interacted with, or you've read what their thoughts. And people write their deepest thoughts in blogs and in tweets often about education, things that they've been wanting to say for ages, but there's not... At school, there's not the time to have these deep and meaningfuls. And often people can't be bothered to think about it too deeply. Not every teacher, you know, that, but you don't get a great deal of opportunity.
No, absolutely.
And then you're suddenly in a room with people who do that a lot. And it's almost overkill. It's almost too much. You see, that's why I want to talk about cocktails. You know, like, it's like, I can't cope with all these people super interested in education. But
absolutely.
And talking of cocktails, Alan, what is your educational cocktail? You don't drink very much, do you? So have you got a non-alcoholic
one? No, I don't. I used to drink a lot, and I had to stop after a particularly forgotten weekend in 1991. So a pretty strong record. So my cocktail is a kind of virgin version of the tequila sunrise, I found out from friends through the Twitter sphere. So it's a mix of grenadine, orange juice with sparkling water. And you can put passion fruit juice in there as well, if those prefer.
Is it layered? Like rainbow delight thing that James did?
It's mixed. It becomes a mix because when the... when the sparkling water is poured in, then it just fuses it all together, pretty much like any other cordial.
Did you link it to education?
Yes, it's because my dad actually came to London in the 1960s, and one of his first jobs, actually his lifetime job, as it turned out, was. As the bartender at the London Hilton, you know, on Park Lane. So he was working at the Trader Vic's bar for nearly 40 years. And because of his experience of being in that sector and working so hard and such long hours, he really impressed upon me and my brothers to kind of get ourselves a decent education. He and my mum were always hoping that we would be... working in lines of work which were reflective of our educational experiences, and wanted us all to go to university. None of us actually went to university in a conventional way.
That's funny. My dad's a little bit similar. My dad came over from Italy in the 70s. He worked as a waiter and then in the restaurant trade as a chef. And he wanted me to be a teacher. And he wanted me to be a teacher because he thought it was a secure job. I wanted to be an artist for a little while. I did always want to be a teacher as well, but I said to him, "Oh, Dad, I had an offer at Edinburgh Art School, and I also got Homerton offered me teacher training."
Right.
And he said, "I said I kind of thought that's 17, 18. I was drawn to Edinburgh. I wanted to be some flouncy artist." And then you listen to your dad if you're Italian, they have a lot of a lot of influence. And he said, "No, Jane, be a teacher." And I did, and I was pleased I did it. I always wanted to be one anyway. So that's kind of similar, that we both had a parental influence on us becoming a teacher. So tell me a bit more about how you came. You said it was an unconventional university route.
Yeah, in actual fact, my dad actually wanted me to become an engineer, but I really, really messed up my life at school. So I ended up getting pretty much getting thrown out of school, not in a really dramatic way, but eased from school into work. So I started working for the civil service in 1986. But I really wanted to go to university. So in 1991, I managed to get myself a place at Birkbeck College, which for those who haven't heard of the organisation, offer part-time degrees by night school. So I spent 4 years studying for my economics degree at Birkbeck. So I worked during the day, finished work at 5 o'clock, and then head over across London from my offices in Victoria to Bloomsbury, where I'd have my 3 hours of lectures and seminars.
That's hard. And then you decided...
It was thoroughly enjoyable.
Yeah.
It was thoroughly enjoyable, yeah.
Quite hard work, though, I should imagine, doing it in the evening after a full day's work.
Well, my mum and dad were really supportive, and they made sure that I had dinner on the table when I got in from college, and then I'd come, you know, I'd eat with them, and then come home back to my own place and just get on with getting ready either for the following day's work or getting ready for another night of learning. I mean, the thing was that working in the civil service is nothing like teaching at all. It is very much a 9-to-5 job. And really, to be honest, sort of office life is what kind of Facebook and Twitter is made for, to be brutally honest, simply because there wasn't the kind of face-to-face pressure that we as teachers have to encounter every day, that smiling.
That.
We have to be smiling from the moment the gates are open till the final student has left the premises.
I don't know about smiling, but you've certainly got to be energetic and upbeat. You can't slump in the corner and say, I'm not feeling it now. Because the minute you do that, the children will just destroy you.
It's such a contrast from being a desk jockey, which is what I did for the best part of 24 years.
So you did this evening thing in engineering, but then you became a teacher. Why was that?
It was because at the end, for those who were around in 1997, the civil service...
That's when I qualified.
Oh, okay. So in 1997, there was a big... the change of government from Conservative to Labour... generated a massive kind of shift in the way the civil service was organised, and particularly with the organisation or the department I was working for. And I saw that change. So I had decided at that point that if I was to be given the golden goodbye, as some of my colleagues were at the time, I would take the offer. As it went, in 2010, Gordon Brown's government realised that the money had run out, and they offered me 2 years salary to leave the civil service. So in 2010, I went off, took the money, and went into teacher training. But before that, I spent a year doing some volunteering work at a great school in North London.
So you then became a teacher in 2015, primary school, yeah?
I started my teacher training in 2011, and in 2012 I qualified, but I had quite a ropey start. For those who are kind of in their early stages of their careers, it is quite a rough road to travel.
And it
took me
a
good few years to get to complete my ECT or what was NQT at the time. So in 2015, I completed my NQT with the school I'm currently working for.
I know a few people who've had difficulty getting from their qualification to being fully qualified. That didn't affect me. I went straight on to supply in 97 and taught in special measures schools in Hackney, but I was a qualified teacher. I had QTS the minute I graduated. I think the QTS thing, like having to have a year as an NQT and then pass something, I think they came in a lot later, maybe a bit later. I don't know. Maybe I'm still not qualified. Who knows? But it's a bit late now, isn't it? After 25 years, they took me on as a permanent member of staff without making me an NQT when I came off of supply, which was about 5 years after that. I was doing a PhD for a while. Anyway, less about me, more about you. You've been teaching since 2015. Is there anything you'd love to do in teaching you haven't had the opportunity to do yet? You've got any ambitions?
No, I'm pretty much where I want to be today. I really genuinely do not have any ambitions for getting into senior leadership. Because of my experience of working in the civil service for so long, where I was doing middle to senior management roles back then, I really don't need to go backwards, back to that kind of lifestyle. It's not something I kind of want or relish. One of the other kind of bonuses from being asked to invited to leave the civil service back in 2010 was that I got my my pension locked in, so I'm able to take retirement when I'm 60. So that's the plan.
Oh, that sounds great. So you class teach, do you? You said in your little bio you sent me that you taught computer science to A level, and you're leading computing at your school, at your primary. But do you have your own class?
No, I don't. I mean, this is the amazing thing. I work for a multi-academy trust.
Oh, right, one of those.
Yeah, but I'm really proud of it.
I'm only joking.
Of course, there are 10 primaries within the trust, and there are a few secondaries as part of the trust. So it's an interesting mix. But because the chief executive and the board of trustees want to adopt a very collegiate approach across all the schools, they have all of us within each of our home schools, as it were, working with other schools across the trust. So as computing lead at my base school, as it were, I currently teach Key Stage 2, all of Key Stage 2 across two schools, as well as reception at both schools.
Oh! And,
yeah, absolutely.
What do you do for computer? Do you do B-bots? Or are they like, that's the only thing I've done so far?
I do something a little bit more sophisticated than B-bots.
Oh, tell me, because I've only got the B-bots in my arsenal at the moment.
I use a fantastic product called... are we advertising now? I have a set of robots called the VexGo, and they are I first saw them being used at secondary level, but I managed to get a set from the team at VexGo, who were wanting to develop their products alongside primary teachers, and they are fantastic.
For reception?
Yeah, absolutely. Because what happens is that you can get the older children within the primary, within your primary setting, to build the robots and initially program the robots, and then introduce programmed robots to the reception children and get the reception children to write programs, which can then be uploaded to the robots themselves.
It sounds
really far-fetched, and it sounds like something that is unfathomable.
I can imagine that happening. I was saying how great primary schools are the other day, and being accused of being divisive, but I think things like that sort of a project, getting year six to go down and teach computing or collaborate with reception to do it,
absolutely,
it's something that is fantastic pedagogically. Yeah. And I don't think it happens that much in secondary. Maybe it does, but I'm going to check out those robots. What are they called again?
They're called VexGo. I can send you so much stuff about it. I love working with the products.
Your talk was on in Research Ed?
It was on practical approaches to primary computing. Yes, and it's the point being is that I think the world underestimates how much reception children are capable of doing.
Well, they're capable of a lot. I mean, I'm joking when I say they can't do anything. They can do an awful lot of stuff. They do. Yeah. They struggle with the basics, like putting on a coat. But you can. They will engage with things.
Exactly.
And they will learn very, very quickly. Incredibly quickly.
Is exactly that. And the thing for me about the B-bots is that they're very limited in terms of just learning how to move a plastic kind of.
But they can can use them better than me. You know, like I showed them a few basic things and now they're getting them doing all sorts of stuff. Just like the marble run. I've got a marble run in my class. I didn't know how to construct it. As being an engineer, you'll appreciate this. Yeah. And there's like a group of little kids in the corner and suddenly the marble run is completely constructed with the wheel going. And I'm like, wow, how did you do that? And they've figured it out. You know, their little four-year-old hands have figured it out. And
absolutely.
They're obsessed with it now. They love that marble run.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to move on to another question because we've spoken for 20 minutes and I've got like three questions down. What would you change in education if you could change something?
I pretty much agree with both Victoria and Eugene that it's the funding thing. And for me, it was the demise of the Building for Schools program. Back in the 1990s, which really kind of disappointed me. I mean, I wasn't involved in education at the time, but I can see where the money has run out, where the money has been spent and where the money has been run out. I've been privileged enough to work in some schools which are purpose-built for the 21st century, and they are amazing places to work.
Don't get me on about the schools we're competing with at the moment in the central London. We've got an old Victorian building. I love our building, but we are competing against these purpose-built academies that are state-of-the-art, multi-million pound buildings, and they're all shiny and new, and parents love them. So, you know, then they don't want to come down our back alley and see the, you know, this three-story Victorian building, even though we've got a beautiful chapel and two libraries and really lovely high ceilings. It doesn't look as cool, does it?
No, it doesn't. But they are, I work in a Victorian building as well, and it is impossible to work in. It's just drafty, it's cold. When I was a class teacher, my last classroom had something like a 15 foot high ceiling. And it's just impossible. It's just impossible to kind of be acoustically kind of focused, as it were, because of the noise level.
I do like those high ceilings, but maybe they are rubbish for... I've got such a loud voice anyway, they can always hear me.
Yeah, and being kind of the lead for technology as well, the capability of wiring up an old Victorian building for bringing digital learning into every classroom is just nigh on impossible.
Yeah. Okay, you're going to like this question because you're an engineer. What is your favourite electrical appliance?
I'm going to deviate slightly and kind of mix Victoria and Eugene's ideas. My radio is just my life. I love listening to the radio, and I'm just tuned in all the time, to the point that my wife and kids just look at me with kind of complete
despair,
just quizzical despair, quizzical stares. That
it's
I've
better than being locked
on.
Onto a scrolling down a screen. I think that's more. Yeah. That's worse. Anyway, yeah, so you love a radio?
Yeah, I have a radio in every room in the house here, and I've actually got a couple of radios where I normally kind of do my planning. So it's like that.
It's quite quaint, really, listening to radio. It's the sort of thing I imagine really old people who listen to the Archers. I never really listen to the radio. I mean, I'm this is supposed to be a radio show. Somebody was saying to me today, a good friend of mine, I'm meeting him later, actually, he said, that's not really a radio show, is it, Jane? It's not on the radio. And I'm like, well, it's called a radio. It's like a, what is it? Is it a podcast? It's live. Is this a radio show or not?
Yeah, it's still a broadcast. We're broadcasting live right now, so people can listen.
So it is a radio show.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
It's just in a different form.
Good. So I can say that I have got a radio show, right?
You're a radio presenter, absolutely, Jane.
Thank you. An amazing one of that, right? Do you think education is lighting a fire, and the beautiful risk of education lighting a fire or filling a pail? I can't even remember how I termed the question. Do you remember how I wrote it down? There?
Yes, I do. I'm going to vary the idea, and that I'm more attracted to Eugene's idea that we're lighting the bucket completely and setting it aflame.
Let's take this apart because I didn't really grill him enough about it. So we're filling children full of facts, like their bucket, and then that fact bucket is going to then become a flame because it's full of facts. Is that is that how that works? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my a good example, I think, is that my son today asked me two really interesting, challenging questions to me. One was about the way sign language started, and the other now kind of escapes me. But the point being is that when children have these why questions or what questions, oh, I just remembered, it was how zips work. But it's just that inquisitiveness that young people have and being able to support their development of that inquisitiveness so
that's lighting a fire, isn't it? Well, the fire is already there.
Yeah, absolutely. But then how do we respond to that fire? By filling it with facts or showing them. Go on.
Do you think the filling the pail analogy is the knowledge centered curriculum? Sorry, hang on a minute. I had to cough then, that's awful.
That's okay. I don't know, because I read this Daisy Christodoulou's Seven Myths of Education a few years ago, and she talks about the idea that with technology being available the way it is now and having a device in our hands where any fact can be kind of retrieved at a moment within seconds would suggest to me that the very subject I teach in computer science is about ensuring that the people I work with are able to sort of evaluate those facts that they see on a screen and be able to interpret them and just apply them in the way that they see fit. So that's why I don't necessarily agree with the bucket analogy anymore.
Okay. All right, that's great. Also, you said you were a nerd and you knew a lot about London. Now, I love London, so can you tell me?
I can tell by your banner as well.
Yeah, I absolutely love London. Can you tell me anything about London I don't already know?
Well, I posted this one this morning when somebody was saying that they were inspired by my morning mugshot, my daily morning mugshot, that the Post Office Tower is one of the worst kept official government secrets, and it wasn't until 1990 that the Post Office Tower was for a long time never allowed to be printed on A to Z maps.
And, why?
Because it was a government communications station. Apparently,
you can't keep something a secret that's like a building, though, can you?
Exactly. So
it was never bunker.
Absolutely. So it was never printed on A to Z maps, and it never officially existed on government records. And apparently, it was a criminal, potentially a criminal offence, to take photographs of the building. And it wasn't until Kate Hoey, the Labour MP, who debated the point in Parliament, that it was kind of decided that actually this interpretation of the Official Secrets Act was rather arcane.
Well, it is, isn't it?
Yeah,
okay,
it is,
so that's kind of historical. And you said you like geography as well. Have you got any geography facts, or is that your fact for me?
No. There's an amazing thing I'm really keen to do, which is called the 33 Peaks Challenge, and that every borough in London has its own kind of high point.
Is that like geotagging?
almost. Where you kind of there are fanatics who kind of try and reach all 33 peaks within a 24-hour period. I'm not ever going to do that myself, but
kind of like the Monopoly pub crawl, but for
for the physical landmarks of across London.
Yeah. Okay, that's really cool. Now, and I'm bang on time, so thank you very much for talking so much. I've had a real problem in my throat the past minute, so that was awful online. Okay, thank you, Alan. Well, hopefully I get to see you in person in the not too distant future. Cheerio.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.